It's astonishing that on a planet of such plenty, there are so many in such need, while people at the very top, you know, are lifting themselves off the planet, but not for long enough.
Welcome to Our Thoughts Tonight. Join us as we chat in a mellow mood about music, philosophy, psychology, and anything else that will come to mind. Enjoy.
I'm very excited to introduce special guest to the show today, Professor Marv Waterstone. He's a Marxist geographer whose research and teaching focuses on the Gramscian notions of hegemony and common sense and their connections to social justice and progressive social change. Professor Waterstone also co-authored the book Consequences of Capitalism, Manufacturing, Discontent, and Resistance with Professor Noam Chomsky. Professor Waterstone and Chomsky co-teach the lectures from the book as a course entitled What is Politics, I believe, at the University of Arizona. How are you doing today, Professor?
I'm fine. Happy to be with you.
I'm happy to have you. Thank you. Could you tell me about how you decided to start teaching the lessons from Consequences of Capitalism and how the lessons were developed?
Sure. Let me give you just a little bit of a very quick background to how the course came together in the way that it did. Noam Chomsky has a number of colleagues and former students in the Department of Linguistics here at the University of Arizona. And for a number of years, he would come out periodically to do some kind of a one-off event of some kind, either some kind of symposium or some other sort of single-shot event. And a number of his colleagues wanted him to come out to Tucson for a longer period of time. He was still living in Boston at the time and still an emeritus professor and still participating in activities at MIT. And he was willing to come out for a longer period of time. But if he did that, he said he was interested in being able to teach an undergraduate course, which he'd not been able to do very often at MIT, or if he did them, they were typically on his own time. And he was interested in doing some undergraduate teaching, given some of the conditions that were going on in the world. And this was around the period about 2015, 2016. So things were, as they are today, quite fraught. But in any event, to teach as a guest at the University of Arizona, to teach an undergraduate course, you have to have a partner who's on the faculty at the U of A. And at the time, the dean of the College of Social and Behavioral Sciences, where linguistics is located, said he knew of such a partner that might be really compatible with Noam coming out. And that was me, and he put me in touch with Noam at that time. And this was in sort of early fall of 2016. And when we first met each other, and the first time we actually spoke was on Noam's very first Skype call. And so having been at MIT for more than 60 years, he still describes himself, I think, quite proudly as a committed technophobe. So he'd never done Skype or anything like that. So we had our first Skype conversation and just got to know each other a little bit. And then shortly thereafter, I proposed a set of topics that we might think about if we were to do a course together. And of course, a number of these were on the top of the agenda at the time in 2016. And unfortunately, a number of them remain at the top of the sort of global agenda even now. And so we settled fairly quickly on some very substantive topics. But what I was interested in doing, and if you've read Noam's work and if you've read interviews with Noam, he is just superb at a kind of up-to-date empirical analysis of global situations.
Yeah, it's amazing, honestly.
It is amazing. It's quite amazing. But what I wanted to do was to put these issues into more of a kind of theoretical framework, because my own work is actually mostly sort of theoretical and social theoretic. And so what I wanted to do was very explicitly link these issues together in such a way that they both made sense in terms of understanding where the issues come from, but also to think about the ways in which, if they have a sort of common underlying causal mechanisms, to think about the politics that that might enable if those things were linked. That is, as we know, there are numerous social movements around the world that tend to get sort of balkanized and tend to get siloed into their own sort of concerns, not surprisingly and somewhat justifiably. But in other ways, I think it makes a lot of sense if there are underlying mechanisms that link these things together to look for those links as a way not only to understand the issues better, but as a way to think about how one might make political coalitions among those issues. So the framework that I developed for the course attempts to do that. And the way that the course is organized, it has a very particular kind of trajectory. And it starts with a fairly banal seeming question. That is, how do we know what we think we know about the world? That is, where do our senses of how the world works come from? And from there, it was very easy to move into, for me at least, a kind of Gramscian framing that thinks about the notion of common sense. And Gramsci adds to the very careful analyses that Karl Marx and others did of how the political economic system works. But those analyses, I think, were in many ways deliberately, but in other ways, simply circumstantially, paying less attention to the sort of ideological underpinnings that maintain those systems in power. And so Gramsci, I think, adds an interesting dimension to think about the ways ideology works, the ways in which common sense is both built and maintained and sometimes subverted in order to allow us to have particular kind of worldviews operating in the way that we understand how the world actually functions. So beginning with that sort of framing to think about how it is we know or think we know what the world is like, I wanted to move into what we can think about as the sort of predominant common sense in the world today. That is, that it makes sense not only in a descriptive fashion to think that capitalism is the predominant political economic way to organize society, but it also seems to make almost unquestioned sense that it ought to operate that way. So both a kind of descriptive framing that this is the way the world does work, but that this is the best of all possible ways in which the world could work, and that that would then organize society in particular ways. And going from there, we were able then to tackle sort of three main areas, substantive main areas of concern. One is militarism, imperialism, and things of that sort, which were very much, as I say, on the agenda in 2016, 2017. In fact, we began the course 1 week before Trump's inauguration in 2017. So things looked very, very, very peculiar from that vantage point of January 2017. The second area was the environmental catastrophe, which is, again, ongoing and still at the top of the agenda in many ways. And then the third area was the sort of less spectacular effects of organizing the world around a capitalist frame. But these are the very mundane, but equally violent, I would suggest, effects of neoliberal globalized capitalism on people's everyday lives in the ways that those forms of social political economic organization touch down in particular places and at particular times. And so very real life consequences of vast income inequality, the disparities in terms of security, in terms of food, shelter, the basics, and quality of life itself. So the sort of neoliberal, globalized, financialized aspect of a capital formation was the third sort of substantive area that we were interested in examining. But we didn't want then to have produced 5 weeks of sort of unrelenting doom and gloom to be the way that we would end this 7.5 week course. And so the last couple of weeks are devoted to the issues of social movements and then social change. So that's the nature of the course. That's the way it came to be. It had the very bland title of What is Politics for a very pragmatic reason. We wanted to offer the course at an introductory level and as a general education course. But to produce such a course from scratch meant there were all kinds of hoops that we would have to jump through bureaucratically, which would mean delaying the start of the course. So what we did was sort of survey a number of courses that were already on the books and find the most generic title we could find that would allow us to do virtually anything we wanted.
That is a rather broad name, but I think it suits it pretty well. And that actually kind of leads to my next question. Actually, before I go on to my next question, I do want to comment. You said the doom and gloom aspect of it. Actually, I was driving home, I think this past Saturday, and I was at the very end of the book, the audiobook version, which is excellent. And the postscript about COVID-19 was the chapter I was on. You know, it was incredibly powerful. And then the next day, I actually tested positive for coronavirus. And it made it even more powerful because of how accurate it is. And COVID is no joke with how it affects healthy people even. It's really awful. And I really enjoyed the postscript. But something you say in chapter 7 that was rather powerful was for social change to occur, the first task that's necessary is to open a space for oppositional critique, not just any critique, but oppositional critique, which relies upon a recognition of the difference between what is and what ought to be or what might be. And I'm wondering if you can explain how society might be able to implement that today.
Before I answer that, let me just say that I've just rewritten that coda at the request. The book is going to come out in a German edition in June, and the editors there were hoping that we could update that a little bit. That coda I wrote just basically at the very beginning of the pandemic, and so a fair amount.
Yeah, it was like the first 3 months or something, it seemed.
Right. Yeah, we ended the course in that year just 1 week before the University of Arizona went on lockdown. So things were just beginning to emerge. But certain elements were very, very easy to predict right at the outset, given the sort of organization of society around things like healthcare and patents and that sort of thing. So I just recently rewrote that or provided an update of that. And again, it's basically a sort of extension of what we expected would likely occur at that moment. But in any event, let me go back to your question about the need to open up a space for oppositional critique. And this comes back to this idea of common sense as being both sort of descriptive and normative. That is, the idea that the prevailing common sense tells us that organizing society along a kind of neoliberal capitalist model is both descriptively useful. That is, that it is the way in which things now must operate. To take one example, it's almost inconceivable now in many parts of the world that one could subsist without renting oneself out as wage laborer. That is, that we take almost completely for granted in many parts of the world, or aspire to it in other parts of the world, that means of production are held in very private hands of the few, and that the rest of us have nothing to sell but our skins as renting ourselves as wage laborers. So that, as a descriptive notion, is extremely prevalent. It is also widespread as a normative element, that this is the best way to organize things, that alternatives to organizing political economic life are themselves quite literally nonsensical. That is, it doesn't make sense to critique this fundamental organization And that's what I mean by opening up an oppositional critique. That is, we need a space that says there's nothing to be taken for granted about organizing society this way. And in fact, if we point to the counterexamples of where this organization fails, this helps us open up both a descriptive and a normative space for critique, and says that perhaps a system that leaves so many behind, and if, particularly if we think about this on a global scale, but we could think about it within countries as well, but leaves so many behind, whether this is in poverty, in homelessness, in precarity, in a planet that's on a careening course to cataclysm, if we're in a world that is constantly at war in one place or another, if we can point to those as manifest failures of organizing society this way. This is one of the ways that we open up an oppositional critique and don't leave the taken for granted. That is, those are the things when we operate in a kind of routinized way, which is what most of life consists of for most people. And it's a good thing that it does in some ways. But if we can open this up, it allows us to think about different kinds of imagination for how things might be organized differently. It's one of the reasons why we see in so many instances counterexamples either thoroughly repressed or trivialized or not covered at all. So if we think about worker cooperatives, or if we think about nations that try to stand up to the capitalist system, Cuba being probably the preeminent example, we can think about the ways in which those who benefit from the system as it exists understand the dangers of a counterexample. And it's the reason why we are kept so much to the sort of party line, that this is a system that works for people, and if it doesn't work, it's your own fault. So it has a whole set of these sort of ideological underpinnings, some of which I think are very carefully embodied in the so-called American dream, which is both a sort of false notion of meritocracy, that, you know, if you work hard, you play by the rules, you could make it. And then the very dangerous and damaging obverse that if you don't make it, you're either not working hard enough, you're not trying hard enough, but in any event, it's your fault. And so the kind of ways that we're kept to thinking about the ways in which society ought to operate preclude us from thinking about offering an oppositional critique. And once that oppositional critique space is opened, I then go on to argue that it's at that point where people are at least open to listening to an alternative view, that we can begin to present this inventory of failures of the present system. But simultaneously, I think it is incumbent on those who are critical to offer a positive view. That is, what sort of alternatives might be available? I don't think it's sufficient to simply have a negative critique, although the negative critique is necessary, but I don't think it's sufficient in order to motivate people to start thinking about how things might operate in a different way. And so, I mean, I think that's what I mean by that sort of orientation, which is why, as I said, we begin the course and sort of end the course with this idea of common sense, which is very, very powerful. And you probably saw the quote that I have in there from Stuart Hall about common sense being a terrain of struggle. And we know that it's a terrain of struggle because we can see in the few instances when that struggle becomes visible, how ardently those who are benefited by the status quo work to maintain that common sense. It is a struggle on their part as well. I mean, you know, escaping that logic is always a possibility. And so those boundaries have to be very, very seriously policed to make sure that people stay within the appropriate sort of rhetorical, discursive, and material bounds.
If I'm not mistaken, there is something that kind of follows. I'm not sure if it's in the same chapter or not, but I believe it's in one of your lectures, and you mentioned that the worst possible thing you can do is is not try to add something to the counter of the status quo or the hegemony, cultural hegemony, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, I think in some ways, maybe a slightly different way to phrase that is that the battles that are and the struggles that are most certain to be lost are the ones that are never engaged. And this is part of, I would say, a hegemonic common sense, is to cast all alternatives to itself as nonsensical. And again, I mean that in the almost most literal way I can be. That is, if struggle looks not only completely unwinnable, but even useless to begin, this, and people believe that, they don't engage in struggle at all. And so I think this is one of the very powerful elements of the hegemonic common sense, is to cast all alternatives to itself as nonsensical. There's no reason to critique them at all. So I think, yes, in some ways, it's definitely the case that if it is possible to open up these areas for critique, that we engage in them. Because once that engagement begins, and once people's minds are open, it's very hard to close them again. This recognizes, of course, all of the sort of practicalities that people face in their everyday lives. I mean, some of us are much more privileged than others to be able to engage in this sort of, thinking and theorizing and so forth. And other people are just extremely busy just trying to make ends meet. But that doesn't say that people, as Gramsci argues, that all people are potentially intellectuals in the sense that they're able to cognize and recognize their own circumstances given the chance. And given that, they're able to then be able to think along with others about alternative ways of organizing how their lives operate. So I think, in many ways for me and for us in the course, this has been a very good entree point to think about how a system that is so woefully and so manifestly inadequate for literally billions of people around the planet can begin to be dismantled.
You said it way better than I possibly could have. I did want to ask a question about your teaching and your schooling. I'm curious how you became interested in Marxism and teaching in general. And also, I think a lot of people, when I mentioned that I would be interviewing you, I mentioned that you were a Marxist geographer, and they're also slightly curious about that. And if I'm not mistaken, you mentioned that briefly in the book as well.
Yeah, well, I'm a tremendous believer, I think, in coincidence and contingency. So my undergraduate degree actually was in molecular and cellular biology.
Wow.
And so this is a long way from, where I am at the moment, lecturing, although there are connections. I'm not going to belabor those. But eventually where I was at the time at the University of Colorado, it was a very exciting time in the mid-70s for molecular biology. It was at the very beginnings of genetic manipulation, gene splicing, and a whole number of things that were just on the verge of taking off. And so it was a very good place to be. And I worked in a very innovative lab at the time, doing very interesting kind of cellular level genetic experimentation. But over a fairly short period of time, I began to be interested more in sort of environmental biology and then to think a little bit more about environmental policy. And at the time, there were a number of people in the geography department, which I'd never really even heard of or thought about or considered, who were doing sort of global scale environmental policy. And I was put in touch with one of these people, whom I very much came to admire and very much liked. And he became the supervisor for my master's thesis, which was in geography. And it was in hazards geography, so floods, earthquakes, that sort of thing. But right away, when I moved to New Jersey to do a PhD, I began to be much more interested in the sort of political economy of hazards, rather than the sort of positive scientistic approach that had been taken in many disciplines, sociology, particularly geography to some extent, political science to some extent, and then in the engineering fields. I began to really be very much more interested in the sort of socio-political elements of hazards and risk. And that led me very, very soon, actually, into reading in Marxist literature. That is, my dissertation was on hazardous waste sites, but I was very, very interested in the ways in which not only did those things get very differentially located spatially, but the very differential capacities of particular communities to respond to those threats. And that led me into a kind of literature to think about how capital organizes the landscape for its own interests, whether that's in terms of extractive production or whether it's in terms of seeing the landscape in some ways as a repository for all kinds of waste, part of which comes out of the obsolescence that's built into a capitalist system, but part of it also emerges just from the fact that capital is an enormously effective machine at throwing out externalities. So things that are not conducive to maximizing the bottom line, those are for other people to take care of. So for me, that became a very powerful lens to think about the sort of substantive matters that I was interested in. So if I was interested in a kind of risk landscape, I had to think about the ways in which capital organizes that landscape. And to me, Marx's analysis of the way in which capital operates was a very, very important and useful entree point for that. There are a whole number of other geographers who either characterize themselves or think about themselves as trying to understand spatial and other phenomena through that kind of lens. That is, it's a very powerful way to think about how space is organized, how things like commodity chains are organized, the way in which the workplace is organized, the way in which cities are organized. All of those sorts of things, I think, lend themselves to that kind of analysis. For me, one other very important step was that in the mid-90s, I actually was the chair of a program at the University of Arizona in comparative cultural and literary studies. And I came in through a kind of science, technology, and society orientation to that department. But it put me in touch with literatures that I'd only sort of touched peripherally in terms of other kinds of social theory. I was at that point very well steeped in a kind of Marxist and materialist analysis. But at the University of Arizona, we have a very fine philosophy department, but it is focused almost entirely on positivist philosophy, on ethics, ancient philosophy, and so forth. Has no continental philosophy, has no social theory. And so this program in comparative and cultural literary studies became de facto the sort of hub for social theory on the campus. And for me, that was extremely productive to engage with people in disciplines, particularly in the humanities. And the program actually emerged out of a previous program in comparative literature. And so, as I say, it put me in touch with whole bodies of theory and work that I was only sort of tangentially involved with. But those things really enriched the way I'm able to think about the kinds of issues that I'm interested in.
The one chapter that actually caused me to email Professor Chomsky about it was I think it must have been one of your lectures. In fact, I messaged Professor Chomsky because I hadn't contacted you at any point, but I had interviewed him in the past. So I just wanted to let him know how amazing the amount of research in that chapter was. And it was the one where you speak about, I believe you mentioned the level of antibiotics in food and the environment, and I believe nuclear waste as well. And maybe that's over the course of a few chapters. I can't remember exactly. But I thought the research was really amazing and that I wanted to compliment you personally. So that's how we connected, obviously. But
That was his all in one chapter. And so you can imagine, I mean, the course is 7.5 weeks.
Yeah.
And so you can imagine from the point of view, you know, a beginning student, which is, you know, where this is pointed. Mm-hmm. You know, it's actually a regular 3-credit course, but it's compressed in time frame. And so it is very, very dense. And we cover a lot of ground. That kind of chapter, I think is meant to be, both a survey in the sense that it tries to be wide ranging, but we also then try to provide both through discussion sections that the students are able to have with teaching assistants and through additional resources, ways to open up, you know, avenues for investigation for the students themselves. So while the pace of the course is very, very brisk and the amount of material is very dense, we try to do it in such a way that it really is inviting rather than foreclosing. That is, that we specify at the beginning that these are going to be sort of opening gambits in what we hope will be ongoing investigations for students in the areas that they're interested in. You know, if we spark a particular kind of interest, we want them to be able to have provided enough of a sort of foothold that people can get a hold of the issue, but somehow also then lead them to the kind of resources that they'll need if they really want to investigate this further. So yeah, I mean, the chapters are wide ranging, but as mm-hmm. I say, we hope that they're not so intimidating that people look at them and go, okay, well, that's it. I'm done with that.
Not at all. I thought it was extremely enlightening and very important research, especially I hope my viewers that are listeners that are listening to this right now, check it out, because some of that information, either I knew some of it or wanted to know some of it, and some of it I never even began to think of, and it was really impressive, and I hope that many people read it. I guess this next question will probably be my last, and that is, what does your research process consist of when taking on a project this large, I guess, between you and Professor Chomsky?
Well, for this course, well, at least at the outset, I had taught courses on almost all of the topics that I cover here in one way or another. So in putting together this particular course, it was a matter of let me take one step back. I saw my role here as being able, in many ways, to provide a kind of platform for the sort of contemporary and empirical material that Noam would bring in the second lecture of the week. So, as I said at the beginning, you know, I think he's just superb not only identifying important kind of phenomena, but in being able to trace them both sort of historically and have them have a kind of coherence for understanding them in the present moment. And so what I tried to do was to take what I thought about as very useful sort of conceptual and theoretical frameworks that would then be a platform for those empirical and contemporary observations. So in most part at the beginning of the course, I was taking material that either I had taught in some way or another, updating it, bringing in, you know, new material to think about, but also very much, as I say, sort of cognizant of this need to provide this kind of framework, conceptual and theoretical framework, for the comments that Noam would make on Thursdays. So that was the way I would do research. Mostly it was, as I say, sort of updating particular kinds of themes, updating particular kinds of formats, and then also changing in some ways the manner of presentation, because in all the years that I taught at the university level, I'd virtually never taught an introductory course. All the courses that I taught were either upper division or graduate courses. And so for me, for example, the second chapter, which is basically a chapter on Marx's analysis of capital, to reduce, you know, what would typically be a semester-long course to a two-hour lecture, you know, was a little bit of a challenge. But in any event, that was the sort of thing that I was doing. Now, over the six times that we've offered the course, what I've tried to do is retain basically the framework, which to me still makes a great deal of sense. The arc of the course still makes sense. But we've changed the content quite substantially to keep up with the times. Some of the more theoretical and conceptual material remains largely the same, but the examples and the substantive content have changed significantly over time. So that's the way that that's evolved. The one other element that has evolved from the second time we taught the course has to do with what I mentioned earlier, not wanting the course to be overwhelmingly pessimistic. And so beginning with the second offering, I started bringing in activists on various elements that the course covers. And some of those in when we were meeting in person, were local activists, sometimes linked to national or international organizations. But as we went, both partially and then more fully online, started to bring in people from everywhere, who were noted experts on the kinds of things, that we're covering in the course, partly to give people, in the course a sense that these problems are being worked on, can be worked on, and that there are places for people to attach themselves if they find, you know, causes and issues that are of particular interest. So a very significant part of the course now is to think about the ways in which, if we're providing a rationale for political action, political cohesion, we need to provide those resources to people as well, at least entree points where people can attach themselves to ongoing activity. I will say that the one question that we get most at the end of the course, I mean, aside from the fact that people say, well, I can't say I enjoyed the course, but I can say that I learned a lot from the course and found it worthwhile. But the one question that we get most consistently, not surprising, what can we do about all this? And I'm working on a paper right now so that we're thinking about how to reorganize the course to be much more specifically addressed to questions about why, given the several century analysis that Marx and others have provided to us, we've had so little success in bringing this system at least to some kind of constraint. And this is, I think, a very, very poignant question. Noam always frames it in a quote from David Hume, which is to the effect that it is puzzling, as Hume said in 1742, it is puzzling the ease with which the few govern the many. And this is, I think, as I say, a more poignant question than ever. And I think we're now at the point where we're going to try to address that really head on in the course and think about what are the obstacles to an organized left? What are the obstacles to producing a space for critique? And what are the obstacles to producing that both negative and critique of the present system? So I think that's where we're at the moment.
All right. Well, that was very insightful. Thank you so much for joining me. It's good to meet you. I really, really enjoyed the book. I hope everybody checks it out. And I'm curious, do you have any final thoughts for anyone that might be listening?
Well, I think I put them in that last couple of statements. I mean, I think it's incumbent on us now to think about a system that, as I said, is so woefully failing billions around the planet and the planet itself to find a way to put at least the brakes on it and start to think about reorganizing in some way how society can function. It's astonishing that on a planet of such plenty, there are so many in such need, while people at the very top are lifting themselves off the planet, but not for long enough.
You couldn't have said it any better. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate you joining me today.
Happy to be with you.